This morning in this part of the show, we'll be talking about the health of the world's oceans, and one issue in particular that we'll be looking at is the issue of marine extinctions. Our guest for the program is Dr. Ellen Pickich. She's professor of marine biology and fisheries at University of Miami, and she is one of a number of scientists who are worried that we may well be on the brink of a gathering wave of ocean extinctions. In the past three centuries, 21 marine species have become extinct. However, 16 of those 21 have occurred since 1972. We'll talk a little bit about the problem, the ways in which humans have contributed to the problem, and what also might be done to solve it, and would be happy to take whatever questions and comments people listening have. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so we could keep the program moving along, but of course, anybody who is listening is welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, and it would be a long-distance call, you may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And in fact, if you were listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can also use the toll-free line. So again, 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. Just a little bit more about our guest, Dr. Ellen Pickich. She is an international expert in fisheries science and management. She's the executive director of the Pew Institute of Ocean Science, which is housed at the Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science in Miami, Florida. She has been working in this area for quite a while. Until October of 2003, she directed ocean strategy for the Wildlife Conservation Society. She's been on the faculty of the University of Washington. There, she was there for 9 years and served as the director of its fisheries Research Institute from 1992 until 1996. She's also led several major oceanographic field expeditions. In 1998, she led an assessment of the U.S. Atlantic large coastal shark populations that showed that these species were more depleted than had previously been thought. And since it's in the neighborhood, I also wanted to mention she got her Ph.D. at Indiana University in Bloomington. I mention that because we have some listeners there in Bloomington. Questions, comments again are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Pickich, hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
We appreciate it. Maybe you could give us a little bit of an overview of ocean health. And then one of the things that we do want to talk about specifically is the issue of extinction. But overall, I think this is something that certainly has concerned scientists now going back some years. And there, as you noted in a story that we came across, you were quoted in the New York Times a couple of years ago, this was at the point where the Bush administration was putting together a panel to coordinate ocean policy. I think you said something to the extent of, you know, we have no shortage of reports and recommendations. There have been a number of major reports issued over the last couple of years. So we do have some database to draw on, so let's do that. And perhaps I can have you talk just in somewhat general terms about the health of the world's oceans.
Sure, David. You know, as you indicated, there have been two major ocean commissions that have issued their recommendations just in the last couple of years. And in 2003, the Pew Ocean Commission issued its findings. And last year, the Bush-appointed commission, the U.S. Ocean Commission, issued recommendations. And the amazing thing was that these were totally independent commissions, yet they came to the same conclusion, the same basic conclusion, which is that the oceans are not only in bad shape, they're in crisis. And I think that's something that the public really, I don't think, would have been expecting. Because for most of us, the oceans seem to be vast and limitless. It's hard to get a grasp on things that are happening underneath the sea, underneath the surface, beyond that which we can see. But you know, there has been a lot of studies documenting the problems in terms of overfishing, in terms of pollution, coastal destruction due to development. You know, all these things are happening, and they've amounted to a crisis.
Well, why don't we talk about some of those things in some greater detail, and perhaps we just take commercial fishing as a place to start, because I'm sure that that connects to this other topic that we said that we wanted to talk about, which was about extinction issues. And I guess this also is something that we have been hearing about now for a number of years, particularly in those places around the United States where there are big fisheries, particularly, I guess, in the Northeast. Some of the same concerns are found in people in Canada, and then in the other side of the Atlantic, where there are places where people depend for their livelihood on fishing. There has been very significant depletion of fish stocks, and we hear about the people who do the fishing. Fishermen have to go out further and further from land than they did before, and the catch is not what it was. And they're being real concerned that some of these fish populations, in fact, may have been depleted to the point where they may never quite recover, or if they do, it takes a very long time. Just how serious a problem is overfishing?
It's an enormous problem. It's just hard to overstate just how serious a problem that it is. And just to give you, I'll give you a couple of examples. Let's take cod fisheries, which had a history in Canada of producing a sustained yield of about 200,000 tons a year. That's an enormous fishery by any standards, today's or in the past. And it sustained that huge catch for more than 400 years. And then just in the last century, with the age of industrialized fishing, and lack of adequate precautions, what we've seen is a real depletion of that fishery to the point that Canada declared a moratorium on fishing in the early 90s. Now, that moratorium has been in place for well over a decade, and yet there is no sign of recovery of that population. So, you know, if there was a poster child for a fishery that was sustainable, it would have been that Canadian cod fishery. Mm-hmm. And now what we're seeing is that it's been so depleted, and even with no fishing pressure at all, it's just not yet coming back. And we don't know what will happen in the future. The same thing is happening in the United States. Cape Cod got its name because of cod. Cod fisheries were very, very abundant there. And now right off the coast of New England, we have the same species undergoing the same kind of depletion. And again, we're worried that this population will follow in the footsteps of the Canadian population. So those are some local examples.
Maybe I'd ask you about the extinctions that have taken place here. And I mentioned at the beginning of the program these numbers that I came across in one of the articles that I was looking at, that in the past 300 years, we've lost 21 marine species, and 16 of those 21 have happened just since 1972. How many of those are fish that were commercially fished, and is that the reason for those extinctions, or some of them?
Well, fishing accounts for about half of the extinctions that have been documented. So yes, I mean, it is the number one factor responsible for marine extinctions.
What are some of the others?
Well, habitat destruction is the second most important factor, and about 30% of the marine extinctions are due to habitat destruction. So the two together make up the whopping majority of reasons for extinction.
Mm-hmm. I know with connection to the sharks, that was one thing that you have been particularly interested in and have done some work in.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, that has to do with habitat destruction, which I guess also connects to development. And all of these things are all tied in together.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to coastal development, what are some of the reasons for habitat destruction?
Well, you know, just going back to sharks for a minute, habitat destruction is important for some of the species, but actually I would say that the major factor there is also overfishing. And the biggest demand for sharks right now is for their fins for use in shark fin soup. And what we've seen is that there's been a burgeoning demand, particularly from China and other Asian countries, which have had growing populations of humans as well, for these fins. Mm-hmm. So I'd say the number one reason is overfishing for sharks, and habitat destruction is also important, but that's number two.
How much does consumer demand for fish as a protein source, which has been going up as people have been advised that it's good for you to have more fish, how much has that contributed to overfishing and then also then to the problem that we're talking about?
Well, I think that the demand, you know, demand is important, that if you have people who think that they will live a healthier life, which in fact fish is good for you. A lot of species of fish are good for your health. That's got to contribute. But I think the biggest problem is a lack of good management. We really have not had sufficient practices and procedures in place to manage fish wisely, and it's allowed this rampant overfishing to occur.
Hmm. Well, why is that? Why is it that these resources haven't been better managed?
Well, I'll take the easier part of that first. If you look at sharks, for example, one big reason is that they fall through the cracks of international law. Many of these species of sharks are very highly migratory. There have been species of sharks that have been clocked at something like a 10,000-mile migration. So they don't recognize international boundaries. And if you look at the world's oceans, you find that there just aren't any regulatory authorities that have the responsibility for managing sharks over a huge area of the ocean. So that's one big problem, just a gap in institutions that have the authority to manage fisheries. Secondly, then you have the United States and other countries where we do have laws in place and have had a regime in place for more than a quarter of a century, and those laws are just not being implemented in the way that they were meant to be.
Mm-hmm. It does seem to be that this is an issue where the best solution to the problem would be some kind of international agreement. But then, of course, that's very difficult to get everybody to agree. It seems it's sort of the classic problem of the commons. You know, how is it that we get everybody to agree on a responsible and sustainable use of what is essentially a common resource?
I think that international action is important. We do have some structure for that. We have the UN Law of the Sea. It just doesn't go far enough at the moment in terms of managing fisheries. And there also are regional agreements that cover certain regions. And, you know, for example, even in the Atlantic, we have an international commission for the conservation of Atlantic tunas. And that commission covers the entire Atlantic Ocean. It covers swordfish, billfish, tunas, and yet it doesn't really manage sharks at the current point in time. So we have gaps. We have a structure to build upon. It just really needs to be built upon. I mean, I think a lot of what we need, if you go back to countries like the United States, where we do have the structure in place, I think that what we're seeing is a lack of political will to take the tough decisions that need to be taken in order to rebuild populations of fish.
And that just a severe kind of restriction on commercial fishing?
Right. You know what, there's a dilemma. The dilemma that I see isn't really so much the dilemma of the commons, but it's the dilemma between what happens in the short run versus taking a long-term perspective. If we were able to manage fisheries wisely, we could really sustain fish catches at high levels into the indefinite future. But what we've been seeing is that because of inadequate management, fish populations start going down a slippery slope. They start to decline. And then you find that you have an industry that's dependent on those catches that doesn't want to see cutbacks because it will definitely have an immediate economic impact on them to have cutbacks now. And so what the politicians are dealing with is trying to balance out the short-term economic dislocation that comes from cutting back quotas versus the long-term need to sustainably manage these fish for all of the nation.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, from time to time, whenever the issue comes up, you see quotes from people who are in the business of fishing, who have been, and their families have been, and you see guys who are saying, my father fished, mm-hmm. my grandfather fished, my that kind of thing, and they seem to think that their sons also should be able to, and maybe they should, but it doesn't seem that you can carry on that kind of drawing on the resource, and that there's going to have to be some sort of scaling back of the industry, that it can't continue, but that people in the industry seem a little hesitant about doing that.
Right. I mean, I actually understand their hesitation. I mean, if you were faced with a mortgage on your house and on your boat and you needed to feed your family, it would be quite a scary proposition to step forward and say, I think that we need to cut the fisheries back, because it's going to have a personal impact on you and your family and your economic situation. So, you know, that's completely understandable. The thing is that our nation needs to find other ways to compensate those individuals or to deal with their situations and think about the longer term, because even if you let them continue overfishing for the next year or two or three, what's going to happen is that ultimately they will lose their livelihoods from fishing, because the fish will all be gone. So it's not in their best interests in the longer term to continue to overfish, and it's not in this country's best interest to allow that to occur. There will be no fish left for their children or their grandchildren, and fishing as a livelihood will disappear.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Ellen Pickich. She is the executive director of the Pew Institute of Ocean Science. It's housed at the Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science in Miami, Florida. She's an international expert in fisheries science and management. And questions are welcome. We have one caller here ready to go. Others are certainly invited. 333-9455 is our Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Indiana. Let's talk with them. Line number four. Hello.
Hello. Two things. First, a cynical remark. It just floored me when you said that the Bush administration's people said that the oceans are in a terrible mess, and it just makes me think they didn't do their politicalizing too well and pick the wrong people, so to speak, because everything else that deals with the environment, they certainly don't come up with those kinds of answers. Second question, I guess, has to do with the food chain or something like that. If these fish that are fished commercially are, let's say they're gone, the sharks mm-hmm. too, what does that do to the ocean population? And I'm thinking along the terms like when they start killing off predators out west, what it does to the food chain there, certainly, or the pyramid. Other populations start increasing, and then they start, you know, eating every vegetation on the land. I was wondering if there's anything along those lines you could answer. Thanks a lot.
Sure. Thanks for the question. You know, there have been, you know, it's hard to say exactly what will happen, but there will definitely be some cascading effects. And one of the ones that's been relatively well studied is one that deals with not quite a fish, but another form of marine life called the sea otter. And there were lots of sea otters in California back at the turn of the last century, and hunting decimated those populations. And what you saw when the sea otters were taken away was that those beautiful kelp forests and all the fish associated with them disappeared as well. And in their wake, what we were left with was a sea urchin barren. Now, how did it come to be that you've removed sea otters and you end up with just, basically a devastated desert-looking ocean floor with just a few sea urchins on it? Well, sea otters feed on sea urchins. You might have seen pictures of them floating at the surface of the ocean on their backs eating sea urchins. And when the otters were gone, the urchins exploded, and they acted like lawnmowers, practically, eating the kelp forests down. And when the kelp forests were gone, the habitat that supported all that other marine life was also gone. So it's too early to predict exactly what will happen if we lose as many sharks as we're afraid that we're going to lose and other species of big fish, but we're certain that we're going to see cascading effects.
Well, has there been anything that you can point to, let's say with the deplete those areas where there's been significant depletion in cod, let's say in the North Atlantic off the coast of the United States, off of Maine, and then off of would be New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, that there where there had been this huge cod fishery in has there been some effect on the ecology there of essentially knocking down the numbers of cod?
There have been effects that have been noticed, and some people would say that that these changes are beneficial. It's a little bit controversial, but what you see is when you take the top predators out of the ocean, it tends to allow the species that are lower down on the food chain to increase in abundance. And things like lobsters and scallops, which pretty much are feeding on the lowest level in the food chain. You know, lobsters are benthic scavengers, so they're eating things on the ocean floor. They started to increase when the cod decreased. Hmm. Some people thought that was a good thing, that there were more lobsters, at least for a while, than there were cod.
So I guess it depends on what it is that you you fish for, but though you're saying that some people thought that was okay, good for a while.
Well, I mean, it was good in that there was some good for a while. From what I understand, and I'm heading into turf that I don't totally keep up on, but I think that didn't persist. And the problem is that if you keep going, once the highest trophic level species are knocked out, then the fishing pressure then shifts to that next group of species, and they end up being fished down as well. So you see serial depletions in the ocean, and sometimes you see things that look good for a while, but then that's the only game in town, so people move on to lobsters. And if we don't get in place, you know, better, stronger fisheries management, then those will go too. Yeah. I mean, the other thing that I think it's important to point out is that it's not only the top predators that are being fished out. They're the ones who I think have taken the hardest hit because they're the most desirable species, and they're the ones that we tend to like the most in terms of eat. That's not always true. Lobster's an exception. But there's also been a lot of fishing on species that are important for food fish for other fish in the sea. A good example in the United States is the menhaden fishery. And many of you may not have heard of menhaden, but it's actually one of the largest fisheries that we have in the United States. And most of that fish is ground up to be used for fertilizer and fish meal to be fed to pigs and poultry and even for fish farms. Just recently, there was a decision to cap the amount of fishing for menhaden in recognition of the fact that if you take away the food fish, you're hurting the bigger fish on the other side of the equation.
Let's talk with another caller here. We have someone on a, I believe, on a cell phone, line number one. Hello.
Okay. A question I have is the impact of delta effects with river deltas around the world. We're familiar with the Mississippi River, but what's the impact of the various major river systems around the world on the ocean and extinctions?
Okay, well, you know, I think I'll just answer some of that because I'm not a river expert. I'm more of a marine expert. But, you know, some of the species that we see at being at greatest risk are the ones that use both the sea and rivers, and that would include the sturgeons, which I write about in this essay on which this article is based. And, you know, for them, the delta is a very important area, very important in terms of nutrients, but also an important passageway. And one of the problems that we've had in terms of fish depletions and extinctions has been habitat alteration. A lot of that's been due to damming of rivers for hydroelectric power, for irrigation, for other purposes. The Mississippi that you referred to, we have yet another problem, which is that there are so many nutrients coming into that river system that it ends up causing what's been referred to as a dead zone, a huge area where there's no oxygen whatsoever in the Gulf of Mexico. So there are lots of issues with rivers and river deltas in terms of contributing to the crisis in the oceans.
Well, that maybe gets at one issue that you mentioned when I talked at the beginning about the big issues, and we haven't really talked about it very much, and that is pollution. Because of the and I think that probably that also has a lot to do with the fact that there are a lot of people living on the coasts, and even more as time has gone along, it's been very desirable. And so we have people living on coastal areas, sometimes in fragile environments and ecosystems where some people would argue people shouldn't be living at all. There are certainly places around the coast of the United States where the coastal waters have been significantly polluted. Just how big an issue is pollution, and is this something that affects, that goes out even further, and it's not just a matter of affecting the waters immediately off the coast?
It does. Pollution does affect the entire ocean. It tends to be concentrated in coastal areas, though. But one of the things is that even if you have something that's concentrated in a coastal area, it can have a big impact on a fish species that spends most of its time out in the middle of the ocean, but depends very importantly on the nearshore area when it's young for breeding, for feeding, for nursery, as a nursery area. You know, we find for a lot of these large fishes that they do come in. The adults come in to either spawn, or in the case of sharks, a lot of them produce live young, and they actually do what's called pupping. They're young, and they do that in coastal areas. So, you know, pollution affects, even if it affects only one life stage of a species, it could do great harm to that species.
There's been now, and I expect we'll hear more reporting on the issue of global warming and its effect on the environment. We know that there has been an average increase in global temperatures on certain places. It's been more significant than that, and there has been fairly significant kind of disruptions in local ecosystems in the Arctic, for example. Is there any concern, or has there been reason to be concerned about changes in water temperature and that having an effect on the things that live in the water?
There's a huge concern about that as well. You know, for some fish, it may not make a big difference. Fish that are widely distributed now and that have a lot of tolerance for different temperatures, you know, they'll probably do okay. Their distribution might change somewhat. But they might do okay. The ones we're really concerned about are species that can't tolerate a wide range of temperatures and also that aren't very mobile. And one of the species groups that falls into that category are coral reefs. Coral reefs go through a process that's been referred to as bleaching when they're under extreme temperature stress. And what bleaching means is that the plant, the algae that lives within the coral that sustains it with nutrients and that gives it their color, leave the coral and give the coral a white ghost-like appearance, which is why it's called bleaching. If that happens for too long, if those temperatures persist for too long, then the actual structure of the coral starts to break down and you're left with just coral rubble instead of coral. So it's not just the coral themselves that we're concerned about, but coral are very important as structural habitat for many other species of marine life, many fishes, many other invertebrates. So it's really the structure that keeps a lot of environments together.
We're a little bit past the midpoint of this hour of Focus 580. Again, I'd like to introduce the guest, and also we'll get on to a caller. We're talking this morning with Dr. Ellen Pickich. She is an international expert in fishery science and management. She's the executive director of the Pew Institute of Ocean Science. That's housed at the Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science in Miami, Florida. And she has done a lot of work in this area until October of 2003. She directed ocean strategy for the Wildlife Conservation Society. Committee. She was also a member of the faculty of the University of Washington for 9 years and served as the director of its Fisheries Research Institute, that from 92 to 1996. If you're interested, by the way, in doing some reading on this subject, you could go to the website of the Pew Institute for Ocean Science, that is, provided you've got the internet access. That's www.pewoceanscience.org, and you can take a look at some of the information that's there, including you can look at this report that we have mentioned that came out in 2003. And questions here on the program are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Caller in Belgium nearby, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Seems though we've gone through exactly what you're talking about before. In Cape Cod area, our forefathers learned how to create whaling ships and conglomerates that went out and decimated the whaling industry. And we've finally come along and made rules against some of these aspects of whaling. Has it worked properly? Is it a model for what we should do for the rest of the oceans?
You know, that's a good question. It did work, and it did work, too, but it was pretty harsh medicine that the world had to take. There was a global agreement, and the agreement was to have a moratorium on all whaling, you know, for a really long time. And there you had a lot of support from the public as well. Most marine life isn't very fuzzy and isn't very charismatic, but people tend to really have a feeling about whales. You know, can we get the same kind of political will to stand behind fish? I love fish, but I don't know how many of you out there do. So I think that was a great approach that was used. It definitely worked to bring back many of the large whale species. And something like that could certainly work for fish. Can we get the political will to do it? That's the big question.
We might also point out that there are still nations in this world that are not signatory to that particular agreement, and they still don't care how many whales they kill, and will continue on at whatever rate they can. Well, thank you very much.
All right,
thank you.
Let's go to another caller here, Charleston, line number 1. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I hope it's germane to the subject matter. I just caught the last few minutes. I was not near the phone, but in any case, the radio. But if I understand what you're talking about, it's the species that we catch and eat and do all the other things that go along with keeping life in one's body, whether it's a fish or a human or whatever context it's taken from. If we fail to control the human population, I think all these efforts are going to be for nothing, because with 6.2 billion people, and they're thinking of about 8 or 12, I don't think this globe can support that. When you take into account humans are just like any other species who eat and excrete the waste, and then in massive amounts, such as it must be worldwide, and the old-fashioned way of just on the ground, and then nature took care of it. Now it's stored, and I think I heard you mention the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. And the last time I heard about that, there was a hurricane of some sort that washed pollution out of off the land and into there, and contributed to that. But I guess what I'm saying is that the whole process is not sustainable when we have to have slaughter animals and other species that we continually eat. And then all that is turned to waste, plus the care and feeding of those animals before they're slaughtered. It just seems one of those things that must be addressed, and soon. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you, Dave.
Okay. That is a related issue, although a little bit peripheral to what we're talking about. That is the issue of population.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess it does bring us back one way or another to the question of if the health of the ocean's not what they should be, how much of that really does have to do with human activity?
you know, again, I think the vast majority of it has to do with human activity. In fact, it's hard to think of reasons the ocean's in trouble that would not in some way be due to human activity.
Let's talk, we talked back at the beginning, you mentioned the fact that there were these two major commissions that issued reports, the Pew Commission in 2003, and then the president appointed a commission in 2004, and mm-hmm. that both of them issued reports, and your comment was it was remarkable because they were independent. They didn't have anything to do with one another, and yet the two commissions released reports and made recommendations that were essentially the same. So here we have two on the table packages of recommendations, and I'm sure that there are other people who have been talking about addressing these issues in other ways for some time. So it's not as if we, as I said at the beginning, and as you said, it's not as if we have a shortage of reports or commissions or recommendations. So now here these have been on the table for a couple of years. Has there been much in the way of action trying to respond by actually doing something to the kind of recommendations that were made by these two commissions?
You know, we haven't seen a lot of action yet, but I'm hopeful that we will see action in this next Congress coming up. There have been some bills that have come up in the United States that have been talked about that would definitely strengthen fisheries management in this country, and you know, the key is what happens to those bills as they go through the political process. There's still time. I mean, there's still time to change things on a global scale. We also do have the United Nations. We have some resolutions, some issues coming up that will be debated later this fall. I mean, this fall could be a very important time internationally because we will be seeing the largest summit of world leaders coming together this September in New York at the UN. One of the things they'll be looking at are where do we stand in terms of meeting the Millennium Development Goals? And those goals include reducing hunger, reducing poverty, and ensuring environmental sustainability. So, you know, it's not too late. There is time. There's not a lot of time, but, you know, I'm really hopeful that the action that needs to be taken will be taken over the next year.
Mm. Well, we're talking about the fact that for this really to work, it really does have to be a matter where there is wide agreement involving governments all around the world that in some cases might even be going against their best interests or the interest of significant industries for those places where fishing is a significant industry, to agree to do what they can to limit fishing, for example. And as a earlier caller pointed out, that there had been this agreement, at least a lot of nations around the world had agreed to not to kill whales, but mm-hmm. that there were some places where they had a long whaling tradition where there was demand for the product, like Japan would be one place, and I think in Scandinavia there are others where they had continued to press for the right to be able to hunt whales. So there in that particular case, while there was widespread agreement on the fact that there was a problem and something needed to be done, there at least were still some people are saying that they wanted to continue to go out and kill whales. Well, it makes one wonder in this particular case whether it's going to be difficult to get the kind of international agreement and cooperation that's really necessary, or there will be some people in some nations who will say, well, we don't really care, or we're saying, well, we think that the people who say there's a problem are wrong and that the fish stocks can continue to support a fishing at a certain level, and we need to continue to do that to support the livelihood of our industry and also to feed people. And that's going to be there are some places where it's going to be difficult to get some nations to sign on.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think, again, the agreement that occurred with whaling is a good example because, you know, maybe not all nations supported it, but even those that didn't, most of them did respect the moratorium for many, many years. So I think that when you do have these international agreements and there's a way to enforce them and monitor them, that you do see that most countries will respect them. And even if there are just a few nations that aren't following the rules, on the whole we saw that some, you know, very important species of whales have recovered not all of them. You know, some of the longer-lived ones have not shown much in the way of recovery, but we've definitely seen some large success stories there. I think, you know, there will be big problems in getting the nations of the world to, you know, to come together and agree to this, but it has to happen, because if you put it, just putting it very simply, without fish, there are no fishermen. If we want to have an industry in the future, if we want our children and our grandchildren and those that come after to have the ability to eat fish, to see fish, we're going to have to do something about it now. Because if we let things go too far, you know, already we've seen these big depletions and we're on the verge. If we don't stop doing something, you know, doing what we're doing very quickly, we're on the verge of a massive wave of ocean extinctions. And then we won't have the option, if that does occur, we won't have the option in the future to roll things back. It'll be too late.
We have just about 10 minutes left in this Barna Focus 580, and again, I'd like to introduce the guest, Dr. Ellen Pickich. She's an international expert in fishery science and management. She's executive director of the Pew Institute of Ocean Science. That's housed at the Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science in Miami, Florida. If you're interested in reading more about them and about this issue, and you have internet access, you can go to their website, which is www.pewoceanscience.org. And here on the program, questions welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Something else that actually we haven't touched on, but I did want to ask you about, and again, in the context of its impact on the larger health of the ocean, and that is aquaculture. Since we have seen more and more, it's grown quite a bit over the last, I don't know how many years, as there has been this continuing demand for protein, and that as the natural stocks of fish have been depleted, there has been this growth in aquaculture, not only in fresh water settings, but also in saltwater settings, mm-hmm. particularly off the coasts, I know in the Northeast. I'm not sure quite so much in the Northwest, but certainly in the Northeast, there's been an awful significant increase in fish farming of salmon. And there are other places where they're looking at other kinds of fish. And people have raised concerns about whether or not large aquaculture operations also will have some impact on the health of the water, at least immediately around where they are, and then possibly even further out. Is that an issue that concerns you?
Yes, it is. I think that aquaculture has some place in the equation, but it's got to be done really carefully. And what we've already seen are some situations where it hasn't been done carefully enough. And I think at this stage in our history, it's premature to allow a large-scale increase in the amount of aquaculture that we see, particularly in the oceans. There are a number of different issues. For example, with the salmon farming that we've seen, a lot of these operations occur in net pens, and we've seen situations where those net pens have caused the escape of fish. Now, in some cases, you see Atlantic salmon being raised in these, you see the wrong species of salmon being raised in a place where they don't naturally occur. And when they escape, they can then go out, establish themselves in areas where they weren't naturally occurring, and outcompete native fishes. So that's one of the issues. Another issue just has to do with ecological balance. Most of these salmon farms are actually fed fish meal. The salmon are fed fish meal in order to produce the fish. And it turns out that there's a net ecological loss for all of these operations. For salmon, it's been estimated that it takes anywhere between 3 to 5 pounds of fish meal to produce 1 pound of salmon flesh. So you're basically turning more fish into fewer fish. Then there are the pollution aspects. Those tend to be concentrated near, you know, very close to the operations themselves. But you do have a concentration of fish. They're producing waste. Also, to prevent disease, you often see antibiotics being used to try to get them to grow more quickly. There are often hormones being used. So all of these things are adding up to cause concern, more than concern, about environmental damage.
Well, how is the industry, that the aquaculture industry, trying to address those things?
You know, I think that there are people in the industry who are trying to find ways to develop better practices. But I think the important thing is that we not give up on our wild fish populations. You know, aquaculture may be able to replace some of the wild fish, but you know, in terms of consumption, but they can't replace the wild fish ecologically. And we've just really got to be sure to preserve our own natural heritage and keep those wild fish stocks going. You know, getting back to the idea of extinction, one of the things that we really haven't touched on is how difficult it is to determine that a species has gone extinct. It's not like you can watch it happen and say, oh, yeah, there it is, it happened. And if you look at the statistics, it takes for something like 40 to 50 years on average from the time a species has last been sighted to the time that it's declared extinct by scientists. And that's because scientists realize this is a very serious call. When you say something is extinct, you know, you better be pretty sure that you're right. And so it's only possible to declare a species extinct after you've spent a lot of time looking for it and have failed to find it. So again, you know, we haven't seen very many marine species being declared extinct, but that doesn't mean that there haven't been a lot that have already occurred that we haven't yet been able to say that they have occurred. There are many species that haven't been seen for a long period of time that, you know, with more studies failing to find them, eventually scientists will feel confident that they can call them extinct. And one reason I find that number important is that if you look at the history of fishing, the timing of when we really saw this large-scale industrialized fishing taking off was after World War II, when the technologies developed there, radar, sonar, heavy winches, freezer capacity out on the high seas. All those things made large-scale, wide-ranging fishing possible. And, you know, we're talking about something that was about half a century ago. So in terms of extinctions, I think that we're going to start seeing the results of that coming up in the next decade to half century.
Right. Well, is there, I'm sure that there is, a list of species that are officially considered to be endangered?
That's right. There's a large list.
How many are there on that list?
You know, unfortunately, I don't know that number, but I'm sure that it's hundreds, if not thousands, of fish species on that list. You know, there was just one example I looked at recently. Sharks in a very limited area in Australasia that looked at hundreds of species of sharks and found, well, no, about 120 species of sharks, and found that about a quarter to a fifth of them were possibly extinct or on the verge of extinction. So, you know, that's in just one very small part of the world.
We have a caller to talk with, another caller here, as we come down to near the end of our time. Someone in Chicago. This is line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. I don't disagree with you. However, I think the problem is basically that there are just too many people that are exist in the world, and that we have to find some way of getting the population down. Our scientists tell us that the Earth now has 6.5 billion people, and about the right amount would be somewhere around 2 to 2.5 billion in the United States. Again, we're overpopulated. We have about 300 million, and scientists believe that the proper population should be somewhere around 125 to 150 million. And until something is done about the population, then these problems with the oceans will continue.
Well, the question was raised by an earlier caller as well. And again, it's certainly an excellent point and worthy of more discussion. It's not quite a little bit off the target of what we're doing here this morning, but it's certainly you can't say Dr. Pickett said, we would not say that it's not relevant or it's not connected.
No, but I think if you look at the world today, hunger is an important factor. But it's really not so much a matter of there not being enough fish out there. There's lots of food available today, and what's happening is that where you see hunger, it's a matter of the food that exists not getting to the right places. We have a distribution problem. You know, people can survive very well without eating any fish at all if they want to. You know, there are a lot of other types of foods available in large supply. And right now, the hunger crisis that we have is in pockets of the world where distribution is an issue or they don't have the ability to self-sustain local food sources. So I think, you know, again, there is a problem with human population size, but that is not the reason why we have a hunger problem in some parts of the world today. And I think that we could even withstand some increase in human population and still be able to feed all the people in the world. The solutions lie elsewhere to that problem.
Hmm. Well, we're just about at the time that we're going to have to finish up. Any last sort of thought that you'd like to lay with people, particularly on the major topic that we're talking about here, ocean health?
I think it's time for people to really understand. You know, it's been one of the myths that we've had for the longest time, that the seas are limitless, that there are lots of fish in the sea. And I guess the message I'd like to leave people with first is that it's just really not true. The evidence is just overwhelming that we're in a crisis in the oceans. And secondly, there are things that you personally can do. At the personal level, people can choose to avoid eating certain types of fish that they know are in trouble. And there are aids to assist you in developing your choices. They're available at our website and other websites. And also, weigh in with your politicians. Politicians tend to hear mostly from the people who want to keep fishing, and they don't tend to hear from the general public. And I think it's important for the general public to speak up and to say, these are our resources, this is our legacy, and the decisions we make today are going to have an impact for a long time to come.
Well, there we will stop. Again, if people are interested in reading up on the subject and looking at the website we mentioned, that is the website of the Pew Institute of Ocean Science, you can go to www.pewoceanscience.org and do some reading there. Our guest this morning, Ellen Pickich, is Executive Director of the Pew Institute of Ocean Science. It's housed at the Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science in Miami, Florida. And Dr. Pickich, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.